There's no mistake here, fellas. The double lip dribbles and mouthing paradiddles belong to none other than that buffoon of stage, screen, and radio, that impresario of operatic impressionism, one Danny Kaye. Welcome back to Hollywood, Danny.
You're listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void on 90.5 WSPS Concord Community Radio. If you're interested in listening at home on your PC, iPhone, or BlackBerry, where this station streams live on the internet, please visit www.wsps.sps.edu or visit my website at radioghost.com for the link. I made tea. First the water in the kettle, and the gas ring on, and then the kettle on the stove. I washed my hands in the warm water with the yellow soap, and I dried them on the counter rag, and then hung the rag over the stove handle, and took up the spoon from the drawer, and the tea bag from the little box on the shelf. And then I stood waiting in the grey, unmoving air for a moment, holding the spoon and the tea bag, waiting for the kettle. What else was there? A cup. I opened the cupboard and took a cup down and closed the cupboard. This was a cup I never quite used, and it was dusty, so I went to the sink and rinsed it, and took the counter rag from the stove handle and wiped the cup dry, and hung the rag on the handle, and again, in the grey unmoving air of my small, old kitchen, I stood waiting, now watching the blue flames of the gas ring blowing its fire at the burned black kettle. I held the spoon and the cup and the tea bag, as though there was no alternative, no other way to have it. We all stand here waiting with our things, like this is how it goes. Tristan had written me out a final note before she'd left. The stalwarts had gone first, taking Arta's body in the late middle darkness of the previous morning. She'd set it in my hands, wrapped about the largest of the keys Arta had long ago entrusted to me. I remembered her dawdling disappearance as she crept in slow motion from either side of my apartment, back and forth, as though she were never leaving, just arranging this and that small item, a paper clip, a pin, a feather, pushing something, rotating something else, before moving soundless out the door in the dull, dying candlelight of the room. I had read the note through once. It was on the counter, and I read it again, deliberately, with the spoon and the tea bag and the cup in the kitchen. "You will be like a morphine ghost," the note began. "At least, that's what they call it. It's a state of very high freedom, a shift in perspective, both subtle and altogether. You may feel as though etherized, or anesthetized, or as though you'd had a type of seizure, or even, strangely, as though a part of your brain were no longer functioning. Really, your mind is just not at all busy, in the place where it used to be, most busy. Imagine the engine of a car disconnected from the wheels. The engine still runs, but the car never moves. At least, not at the urging of the engine. The secret, you will discover, the paradox, is that the car will still move. The universe moves it. There can be this subsequent feeling of loss, of transparency and numbness, of a morphine-like condition of blissful abidance, alongside a semi-present, ghost-like aspect, both here and not here. There will be this drift. You are no longer anchored, and you are no longer in control. and you will not be alarmed or bothered by this. You will find yourself with a lack of problems, without qualities, and with an absolute and beautiful lack of purpose. It is generally the experience of those who have undergone the Bodhisattva to marry themselves into a very long period of indolence, of non-doing. You may have no inclination even to get up from your bed to eat. Just lying there may be enough. I will return shortly to make sure you are not engaging in this extreme form of intraction. Unfortunately, or fortunately, there are things left to be done. You'll remember that Arthur entrusted his set of keys to you. I will leave with you, as he instructed me to, the largest of these keys. We don't know, and in fact, Arthur did not know, into what lock the largest key fitted. We do know, however, according to the book you've just completed, that you will, in the coming hours or days, make such a discovery. The kettle began to tremble in its boil like a small metal house that wanted to leave everywhere all at once. A morphine ghost. Had I written the book? Was I even here? I remembered a looming deadline. I remembered only not writing it, sitting at the typewriter and not proceeding. Excepting, of course, with my poem, "First You Let Go of the Rain." The kettle veered toward its boil. The whistle rose around the kettle neck, throttling upward its beautiful water smoke as the liquid inside exploded in the primordial transition from liquid to gas. Ah, I felt, that is the ghost-like feeling of sensing a transition from liquid to gas, of a change of state. I put the tea bag in the cup and set the cup on the counter and took the rag again into my hand, as the kettle handle was always too hot, and I wrapped the rag twice around the handle and lifted the kettle and began to pour. In the past, I'd permitted the burn to my hand. In the organized swamp of my ultra-efficiency, such light injury had been unavoidable. It took too much time to fetch the cloth. No umbrella for me in the rain in the old days. Good ones were too expensive, and they were cumbersome. You could see the streets lined with umbrellas during a rainstorm, like the spindly skeletons of undertakers filling the garbage cans. And the body and the clothes dry quick and by, and the umbrella would only slow you down along your way, fighting against the wind. I used to run through the rain and keep tight to the buildings, and pause under awnings to re-establish my flight path. Cold in the winter, underdressed. I dressed the same all year round, a plain suit, a little sweaty in the summer. I couldn't stand the useless bulk of the big jacket and mittens, and the itching, bad idea of a hat. And where to store such things for the 8 months they went unused? Or in restaurants when one sat, cold in my bed in the thin sheets, and extraordinarily careful about the heating bill. Only the kitchen light ever on, the other bulbs unturned in the socket just to make sure, to save. The primary, ultra-precision of saving and scrimping and efficiency. I failed to notice that being cold and wet and miserable and malnourished in a dim light with a burnt hand were not the fine rewards of efficiency, but rather the economical stigmata of self-flagellation. The water scrambled in the cup as I poured, but quickly fell into itself as the first red bloom of the tea broke out to one side. I held my spoon above the water, looking down. I liked my tea plain in the past, not for the taste, but for the sake of ease. I did not like an excess of steps, but I would add milk today, and honey. I took the note in my hand, sipped the tea, and continued. You will of course not remember having written Streamlines of the Futurist. You will however recall our mutually agreed upon vow of silence, and you will also remember sleeping in the main study. What you do not remember is that while you slept, I sat at the typewriter and transcribed your unconscious dictation. We have found this method of constraining or eliminating talk during the waking hours conducive to such sleep talking. I will stop by shortly to see you. you may find yourself in a deeply empathetic state, untethered and drifting. You may find yourself out of your body, shifting here to there, from this person to that, or even this thing to that. Suddenly you will be the floor you are walking on, or the shoes on your feet, or the man in the car, or the boy in the airplane, or the cloud looking down on the city. Such is the initial experience of the morphine ghost. There is no insistence that these experiences be considered real. I'm sure you are well. The old business is done, Sherwin. Let the new business begin. My kindest regards, Tristram. The tea was gone, and the note was read, and the sky was growing dark. I got up and set the cup on the sill, and sat down in the window chair. It was getting cold in the apartment, and the shiver ran down my spine. I got up and found the thermostat. There was a hiss from the hall vents, and a sudden scent of chimney dust and creosote, as the cauldron in the basement began to breathe into my long-disused ducts. I retrieved the comforter from the bed and wrapped it around my body and sat again. Next door, there came the sound of music, of Eddie Cantor, or Danny Kaye, or Johnny Cane, or Sammy Khan, or Jimmy Croon. The old woman, Edna, who did her laundry all the time and listened to an AM station. It was all laundry for her all day, from her own closet, her own pile of goods, her bureau, whatever she proclaimed. A radio propped on the windowsill, and the window opened even in the winter. Not too loudly, but strangely, ever always, the music in the background, pressing at my walls in a thump, and splashing and squeaking at my windows its lighter notes all day, all night, without reprieve. There are those who put their radios in open windows. They do their laundry, and listen, and they always have laundry. And the world is listening too, or they are asking the world to listen. I am doing the laundry, and the radio is in the window, facing out toward the world all day, all night. I am here doing laundry. Please listen. We are all hearing this together, you and I. We are sharing the world and sharing this. We are doing laundry, listening. You and I all gathered round. Don't you see? Do you understand this now? How this works is like this on the fifth floor. I'm doing my laundry, and my son doesn't visit, and that's how it is for some. He can't come, he's so far away. But then why is that? Was that even necessary, with Albert dead for so long ago now? A son would stay nearby when his mother went alone like that. And what have I done since? I cannot take the radio down. You see, it's there, and has been for such a long time. We've gotten used to it. I will put the volume down. But I need it there. Let's leave it for now, and you just see. I've had it like that for years. I mean, for years it's been just like this, and no one complained. So you just see. You just see if you still feel that way. I will not turn it in. I like it out. Facing out, not in. It's appreciated. You'll see. But I will turn it down if you give it a right chance. If you wait and see and give it a right chance. Because I've had it there for years without any change or complaint. And there's no one minding. You see, that's the thing. I couldn't have that. So just for me, you could just see. That's all I ask. Just wait and see and give it time. I don't mind about the window open, even when it's cold. I like the cold. You'll see the steam go out if you stand on the sidewalk below. Watch it like a river go out the window. It all goes out together in the shape of smoke, the steam from the hot water in the big machine. But I like my fresh air too, and that comes in. Someone came once and said they appreciated my radio. We're all here listening. That's all there is. And that's the only reason anyone's here. So you just think about that, and wait and see. I've never had a complaint. Not one. Not even once. I sat with my tea and my blanket. I was at the window listening to Eddie Cantor, or Danny Kaye, or Johnny Cain, or Sammy Kahn, or Jimmy Croon. And there were moments of drift like this. Departing, removing, elsewhere moments, my eyes dissolving from one scene to the next. No longer here. Not quite there, glistening in the next room over, doing the laundry in the cold room with the hot steam. My old red hands folding down the corners of the sheets, the nervous energy of every dry finger, and then checking the door peephole. Someone in the hall. Who's coming now? It can't be Albert. He's still dead, and David won't come. He'll never come, because he forgot all about us and went away. I hope they don't ask me to turn it down. The light was pouring in upon me, baffling in around me, so bright and complete my eyes had to shut, pouring against me in a soft force of wind, as the new day came, as though all the light upon the everywhere had seen me and come running. There he is, and here you are. I felt the light vibrating its meaning as it covered over me, hot snowflakes melting on my skin, sand from the sand truck. Running me down like a shuffler's wind, like a thousand children tackling me with their whispering lips, all my own children rushing for my embrace after a long trip away from home. But I'm back, and what that means is that we're back now. Here we are, my red stiff tired fingers folding down the corners of the sheets, and the noises in the hall for my eyes, the peephole. It can't be Albert. Albert's dead now these long years. And David, I can't say as you could even see he was my son. He's so far away now, and so no longer here, and never calls or comes, and no cards. When was the last time? Wait and see. Wait and see. Not one complaint. I fell asleep, or fell away, or fell wherever I fell. And when I woke in the chair, it was to the sound of a bird outside my window. A blackbird whistling on the sill. Behind that, everlasting. Was Eddie Cantor, or Danny Kaye, or Johnny Cain, or Sammy Kahn, or Jimmy Croon. The shape of the bird was the sound of the radio on the ledge next door. I lay like that for hours, morphine ghost, moving between all these, sometimes the bird, sometimes Edna next door, sometimes this body. Sometimes for a moment on the street checking my watch, looking this way, that, late for the next place down there, hastening, displeased with this spot, upset with this post now. Sometimes the pavement, flat, outstretched, well slept with the indigestion of large trucks. When would there be arrival? When would somewhere be gained? After a time, there was hunger, and I stood and went into the kitchen and ate crackers, and then back to the bathroom, and then back to bed. Was this the extreme form of interaction Tristan mentioned? I wanted better food and would go out tomorrow. Hot soup, things with taste, the spice of salt and sweet and sour. I would take care to bring this to myself. This was not the extreme form. I was not in bed with a teetery smile, half comatose in the extremis, and lost vapors of the morphine ghost. I was more practically here in the chair, and I don't know if I was smiling. Almost dull, almost bored, but there was no boredom, no dullness, but sharpness and open vision. How to explain that? Almost bored, but not at all bored. Intake, width, absorption. It was dark out, and a yellow-black sky, and the bird was still rooting at the window. I cracked it open. Maybe it was wanting to come in. Come in, bird, I said. Come out, man, it said. I sat beside the narrow jet of the cold air, sliding in under through the window space. The bird troubled off with my action, but then alighted and then flew off again, and then stood on the sill just below the jamb, as though to prevent my closing the window. You want it open, I said. You want it closed, the bird said. You want to pay the heating bill, I said. No, the bird said. We smiled. I will leave it open, I said finally. The bird sang and danced and hopped here and there. I was holding the large key. It was old-fashioned, man-made, hammered in a forge. The gray silver was pocked and pitted black. A child's fantasy key, like a treasure map marked with an X. A skeleton key, pirate key, a wizard's key. The key I somehow would shortly insert in some lock somewhere. How would I find out? How will I find this out, bird? I set the key on the sill. I'll give this to you, bird, and you tell me what the world says. The bird flew off when I set the key down, but then returned. Edna was sleeping, snoozing, in the cleanest, fullest set of nice sheets that smelled of lavender and flower fields and blankets and comforters in the violet canyons of her many soft feather pillows. She was good to herself in her bedding. She took care of herself here, loved herself in the place of sleep. I went to the kitchen and had crackers, water, and went to the bathroom, and then was laying in the tub in the warm water, watching the snake ripples my unrowdy heart slithered upon the gallons, and from the faucet near my toes, a tick, tock, drip that kept its own time. The bird was standing on the key, its taloned foot grappling with it. I watched the droplets fill and fall, fill and fall. A new droplet each time, but the same droplet. And when the bath water lost the flagrant edge of its heat, I stood. The bird was dragging the key toward the sill ledge. It would jump with it. I will jump with it, and I will fly with it, no matter what, at any cost. I dressed into my old clothes, my dark old pants and rough cotton shirt, my jacket, and everything smelled medicinal, rotten, of gin, sweat, ointments, cinnamon, mothballs. Of an old man dying, trying hard for the other direction with his steadfast bay-leaf captain's musk, his spiced Christmas cologne of 50 years. The bird in the cold air heaving down toward the street like a rock, wings exploding against the bring-down iron of the heavy key, until it gives forward into the full force and drums for more speed, and then turning that into lift with a narrow hard cock of the wings, and buckling those wings to bank sharply away from the fast-approaching wall of the building across the street, petrified, nervous, silent screaming into a thick curve, rising up, up, into the yellow-black sky. My window blackbird, my skeleton key, like my hand moving out above the city, against the sky, extending toward the lock of some distant unknown door. Where does it fit, bird? I shut the window. The way things went was this way. Whatever would be like this. Why not? The bird would take the key. The window would be shut. The universe would do the rest. The universe did all the prior rest. This was just an acknowledgement. I was the oarlock, not the oar. There was no question. There was only this way of finding out. That is how it happens. Every particle in the universe leans together in the moment and finds itself arriving at the next, and ever leaning all together, moves together toward the next.
Bunch of coconuts. There they are, standing in a row. Big ones, small ones, some as big as your head. Give them a twist, a flick of the wrist, that's what the showman said. I've got a lovely bunch of coconuts. Every ball you throw will make me rich. There stands me wife, the idol of me life, singing roly ball, a ball, a penny, a pitch.
Singing roly ball, a ball, a penny, a pitch. Singing roly ball, a ball, a penny, a pitch.
Roly ball, a ball, roly ball, a ball, singing roly ball, a ball, a penny, a pitch.
Am I here? I wanted to ask, but I fell asleep, or fell away, or fell wherever I fell. And when I woke, it was to the sound of a jet in the night sky, the ice-scraping sound of a jet in the sky, the ripping up of the old sheets sound of a jet. The thieving blackbird flying far down along the way against the yellow-black of the sky, the extension, the dressing of my hand, stopping with huge, tottering sways in the high tree in the park for a moment to rest and look and rest and find its next heading, and then plunging as before, but now stronger and used to the headlong risk of the dive and of the bulky strange cargo locked in its talons, my arm sliding over the city, pushing along for the lock, turning forward the key, down this street and up the next, and then for no reason but for the sake of right timing, beelining toward the little pretty song box in the window. Eddie Cantor, or Danny Kaye, or Johnny Kane, or Sammy Kahn, or Jimmy Croon, and alighting there with the dull clank of the key hitting against the brick of the sill, and waking someone up with the noise, staring at the radio, up close, much too loud, and hitting at it, rocking it, pecking it, how strong we'd become by way of our recent burden. So strong, in fact, that the radio now explodes on the sidewalk 5 stories down below, its white bakelite sides shattering into a pattern of little knives, and the tube inside a dead eye, and a spread-out sizzle of smoke from the wide splashing impact. Edna rushing from her bed. How could a bird do this after all these years? A bird, for goodness sake. Did birds even do things? Did they ever, along the surface, an action such as this? In the history of the world, has a bird ever done such mischief? Does it understand what it's done? No, Eddie Cantor, or Danny Kaye, or Johnny Kane, or Sammy Kahn, or Jimmy Croon. On the street below, looking up from the litter and wreckage, a championship man who lives nearby claps, staring at Edna. Thank God, he shouts up. Do you hear me? Thank God. Not one complaint, Edna calls back, her finger waggling in the city air. And how long can this go on now in the room, this new, abusing silence? How could anyone live in the all-quiet room? And what about the world? Thank God! Thank God! The man is still shouting, stomping on the debris. Not one complaint, Edna says again. And then she remembers and shouts her memory. I have another! The man below drops his thrilling arms. The grin dries on his face. His eyes grow tired. He walks into the still, dark morning air as though it had never happened. I have another. In Albert's facility, there was another one there in the box on the shelf. They had been given two at their wedding. What a thoughtful, well-working gift. But the storage facility was down near the lake, near the old house, and Edna wasn't sure she could manage, even by bus, and the key had been lost so many years ago. Was it missing? Was it misplaced? She hated to think of it. Hated, because this was not a normal case. This was not a normal. Edna lifted the key from the sill. All along right here? She wondered. Who could put this here? Albert? But not David, though. But some love of hers had left it here in the perfect way, knowing that her radio would one day cease to be, and at that moment she'd find it. I have another, she shouted out the window, showing the key. There were all the old clothes there from the children and every year, for how could they part with these things? Albert, how could we part? These are our things, David's and Devon's. Even though Devon's gone, we need to keep this as part of Devon. This is our world, our bodies, Albert. There is no such thing as getting rid of. No such thing, don't ask me to. In clean clothes, waiting for the last bus to the lake, and then she would walk up Lake Drive, past the old house, too hard even to look at now, with its fallen-down face and rotten porch. And how lucky they'd been to live there back then when it mattered. Right near the facility, almost every week she'd brought a box over. Keepsakes, keepsakes, forever and ever. Our life, Albert. Us. A series of metal bunkers, each with a light and a prison yard set off by fencing, Edna approached door 13 and took the key from her pocket and fitted it into the old lock and turned. My hand across the distances turned. I made tea, first the water in the kettle and the gas ring on, and then the kettle on the stove. I washed my hands in the warm water with the yellow soap in the shape of a lemon, and I dried them on the counter rag, and then hung the rag over the stove handle, and took up the spoon from the drawer, and the tea bag from the little box in the shelf, and then I stood waiting in the grey, unmoving air for a moment, holding the spoon and the tea bag, waiting for the kettle. What else was there? A cup. All the old, old clothes in their boxes. All the old, old things in their older things. All the old, old boxes. Our life, Albert. Edna reached for the light switch. We reached for the light switch. In the stale smell of an intimate and shut away and secret world, as the bird flew across the yellow-black sky, we reached for the light switch. I was sitting in the window chair, flying across the yellow-black sky, reaching for the light switch. In the stale smell of an intimate and shut away and secret world. You've been listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void on 90.5 WSPS Concord Community Radio. For more information on the show and the songs, please visit my website at radioghost.com. I'm Sherwin Sleeves. Tune in next Friday at 5 p.m. for more stories and music. Thank you, my friends.